Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today, I have the first ever EMPA of the year by Simpa, Major Jonathan Monti. John here is, we've been having a great conversation so far, talking about his experiences and what has brought him here. John is, as you can tell with the title of Major Monti, is actually an EMPA in the military, in the U.S. Army, and he has some battlefield experience and some different backgrounds. So I was hoping to talk to John more about his experiences. And, well, I guess we should just let John tell us everything about it, because it sounds like he's got a great story.
Hey, Chip. My name is Jonathan Monti. I am an emergency medicine PA who is currently on active duty in the U.S. Army, and I'm currently stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. I can tell you that my PA career actually began in pursuit of medicine, but actually it began I was supposed to start as a nurse. Fortunately, the PA profession was booming at that time. This was the mid-90s, and I knew I didn't want to spend half of my life in training like physicians do with their residencies, but I knew I didn't want to do nursing care, so I had discovered the PA profession through my sister, who was actually in PA school, and said, that's for me. So I actually won a scholarship for PA school through the Army ROTC program, and was able to attend PA school while doing Army ROTC, and owed them 4 years afterwards. I found myself at the end of those first 4 years that I actually enjoyed the autonomy that Army PAs have in comparison to many of the civilian PAs at the time. So I actually opted to stay in, and here I am 17 years later, still serving as an Army EMPA. Actually, my career in emergency medicine didn't start until 2007, and what led me to that career was essentially I got deployed very early on in my career as a vanilla PA, non-specialty trained. And for those that don't know, military PAs are basically, when we go to war, we're expected to be able to resuscitate trauma patients and handle emergencies just like any other PA who's trained in those things. However, we don't have that training. So I felt woefully underprepared for those duties during my first two deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. So in order to feel more prepared, I actually sought out the military's EMPA residency, which at the time was switching over from a 12-month certificate program to a 18-month doctoral degree-producing program, which incorporated clinical research. That was a wonderful opportunity. It started my emergency medicine career.
Now, you're the first person I've met who's actually gone through the doctoral program, and it sounds so intensive. And I remember when it first came out, it was a controversy about, why are we giving PAs doctorates? Shouldn't that be something that we reserve for, well, doctors, physicians? I'm really curious your thoughts to some of that controversy, as well as what you thought of the actual program itself, because from everything I've understood, it's an amazing program with lots of detail and lots of information it offers. So do you mind speaking a little bit about that, John?
Yeah, so the program itself, it's a top-notch program. It's excellent. It is academically intense, but clinically focused. So much of our residents spend their time actually in ED, whether they be pediatric EDs, just your normal emergency departments, or doing trauma resuscitation, amongst other rotations. So the training is excellent, and we've incorporated clinical research, and we focus on prospective clinical research for our residents. It's an 18-month program, and those that leave from it are imminently qualified to care for patients in an austere setting or resource-constrained environment on their own autonomously, and are able to do so in a very competent fashion. So it's a great program. In regards to the doctoral degree itself, none of those that have gone through the program have desired the title of doctor. I think we had a 12-month certificate program that was very intense, and to receive basically a certificate for that was a little bit disconcerting. So the Army looked to develop this program that was essentially used as a retention tool to offer the doctoral degree should they complete the program. My take on the degree is that it was never intended to be a entry-level degree. It was always something that was reserved for PAs, and that's how we actually run the program, is that PAs who actually have combat experience, who have time as a PA, are the only people who are eligible to apply for the program. So we look at it more as a fellowship as opposed to a entry-level training or residency.
And that, I hope, helps explain to people why this is a different program. It is more of a fellowship type. It is more of a postgraduate program. And to me, that's why I felt like when I read about it more and I understood what it was, that it made more sense. I do have another question for you. You're a lover of POCUS, from what I've gathered, and Frank has told me a lot about you, Frank Norman. You two basically started SPACUS, from my understanding, and it sounds like you have an interesting story about Frank with that, but also about, I'm curious how you got into POCUS. What made you decide that you wanted to use ultrasound for your patients?
That is an excellent question. I'd love to tell this story. I was in Afghanistan in 2005, and those that don't know what deployments are like, they are hours of sheer boredom peppered with moments of chaos. And so in order to fill those moments of boredom, you read lots of books. And one of those books was actually Mon Mateer's first emergency ultrasound book. And we had a portable ultrasound machine with us. And essentially, I taught myself how to use the machine for emergency patients, and it seemed rather easy, relatively. And interestingly, we had a mask house situation. We had multiple patients come in, and during my treatment of one of those patients, I noted with the ultrasound that this patient had a large pericardial effusion. He had multiple shrapnel wounds to his thorax, and they appeared to be very superficial, but we all know that penetrating wounds can be very, very deceiving. So when I put the ultrasound on him, I saw this large pericardial effusion, and I went and showed the surgeon. He said, yep, looks like it. And I said, it looks just like the book that I had just taught myself. So, and sure enough, one of the nurses who was with us, who had much more time in patient care than I at the time, came over and said, hey, take a look at this. He's got distended neck veins, and he's borderline hypotensive. Did you listen to his heart? And sure enough, I listened to his heart, and he had muffled heart tones. So it was eye-opening for me. That led me to actually pursue my doctoral research using ultrasound. And basically, I wanted to show or demonstrate that PAs could use ultrasound to accurately detect pneumothorax. And we used swine models in that study. And it showed that they were very, very good at detecting pneumothorax. Since then, I've been a huge fan of ultrasound and POCUS, and believe that it is a tool that can have a significant impact on a minority of the patients that you see. So I have always encouraged it. While I was doing the ultrasound fellowship that the Army actually was smart enough to create, Frank called me to say, hey, I'm interested in ultrasound, and you seem to be too. I found your name on the internet, and that actually led to the origins of SPACUS, and we are continuing to try and capitalize on that relationship to this day.
I'm not sure what to think if he had your phone number, that he just Googled it or something. That's almost a little concerning. That sounds almost borderline for Frank, if that's a little stalkerish. But Frank, if you're listening, I'm just kidding with you. So anyway, that was a great story. And actually, it kind of leads me to ask a second part to this experience. When you're doing all these scans and you're learning on your own, and this is much of the way I had to learn, given it wasn't on the battlefield, but it was just learning and trying to figure out on my own. I know what I did was, whenever possible, I try to get the confirmatory exam of choice, such as if I had a positive EFAS and it was appropriate for that patient, we'd go to CT. If it was an abscess, I would then perform an IND. And if I got pus to come out, it probably was an abscess. But my question is for you in that kind of setting, especially if you're not having, you know, basically a lot of your patients, they're coming in, they're probably more serious or they're probably more time dependent. The Army's very big about that, from my understanding, about you get these people in and out as quickly as possible in the appropriate direction. How did you get that experience with ultrasound and then turn around and apply it to patients without much formal training, like many of us who are learning it on our own?
So you have to have some people locally that are champions of point-of-care ultrasound in order to be able to effectively mentor you and coach you through that training period. You know, the American College of Emergency Physicians has long led the way in point-of-care ultrasound, and they were the first to kind of outline guidelines that say this is what we recommend as a minimum to achieve competency or proficiency in emergency ultrasound. Those guidelines basically say that you should have an introductory training, whether it be a 24, 48, 72-hour course, followed by a proctored phase where essentially you're just scanning, but you have someone supervising those scans and giving you feedback and helping you and guiding you in your technique. And once you reach that minimum number, usually about 150 to 300 general scans, and then another 25 to 50 per specific application, there's really not a whole lot of, there shouldn't be a whole lot of credentialing boards or bodies that would be unwilling to credentialing you if you've met these guidelines that ASEP has come up with. So really, you require machines and you require a mentor and you have to have the desire to scan. And usually that comes from recognizing the impact that point-of-care ultrasound can have on your patients.
Now, when you were learning out basically in the field on deployment, who acted as your guru or your mentor during that time frame?
So that's a great question. Initially, there wasn't a whole lot on the ground. In fact, the surgeon who was with me with the forward surgical team, he didn't have a whole lot of experience. In fact, when I showed him the images, he said, yeah, that does look just like the book. And he actually took that patient to the operating room and found that there was a large piece of shrapnel embedded in that patient's right ventricle. So I'm glad it kind of validated his views of the images as well. Beyond that, it was a challenge downrange. There, unless they were emergency trained and had training with ultrasound, there wasn't a whole lot of mentorship available. Eventually, the Army got smart and they offered a tele-ultrasound program where you could actually send your images to someone remotely back in the States, and they could give you not quite real-time, but close to real-time feedback on those image findings and give you a recommendation based on your clinical picture.
That is really neat. I didn't know about the whole basically telemedicine side. So that's actually rather interesting there. I think it's a big point, like what you just said, having that confirmation, especially early on in ultrasound when you're trying to figure out how you're going to do this. And you're a little intimidated, I'm sure. I mean, at least I was intimidated when I was doing the first scans on my own. And you know, I have to go and tell the surgeon or, you know, my collaborating physician, whoever it was at the time, about my findings. And sometimes they're trying to figure out, well, how are you qualified for this or anything else? But in the end, I felt like it was so important to get those early scans that were validated by whoever looked at them later. And I think in that case, it sounds like it's very important to your future. And probably if it had a negative outcome there, probably would have negatively impacted your future in ultrasound too. So I'm glad to hear that you had a good experience with that. For someone who's listening and somehow has listened to all the different POCUS podcasts we've had and is still a skeptic as far as whether or not they should do it, I mean, do you have any advice to them on maybe how they can start incorporating this?
Sure. What I like to tell people about POCUS is that it's not going to have an impact on a majority of your patients. In fact, the number that it will, it's going to be a smaller number. However, it will have a profound impact on those that it does impact. However, the only way that you're going to get good at POCUS is by scanning. And really, the way I think of scanning is it's hard to find a reason not to put an ultrasound transducer on a patient for whatever complaint there are. There's so many applications in which you can use ultrasound that I challenge people to find a reason not to put an ultrasound transducer on them. And that's actually how you gain competence and confidence, is the more scanning that you do, the better that you get. So again, it may not impact every patient that you're putting it on, but you will find patients that it will profoundly impact.
Very glad you said that. And actually, I think one of the big things to remember that from that is there are going to be a lot of patients you put the ultrasound on. Like you said, doesn't make much of an impact, if any, but you're not going to know until you do it. And I think that's a big point to remember. Now, I can't talk to you all about POCUS. I'd love to, but I think think some other people out here are probably going to listen to some of your other activities, because if I understood correctly from just a few minutes ago, it sounds like you've changed gears over time and you've moved on to more of an academic role. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the stuff you're working on or what you plan on working on in the future?
Absolutely. So as I said in the speech, I never envisioned that I would lose my passion for emergency medicine when I first began my career over a decade ago. But it is exactly what happened. Burnout is a very, very real problem these days, and it seems to be increasingly prevalent, unfortunately. I think that has a lot to do with our current healthcare culture. It happened to me. I kind of got mired in countless night shifts filled with difficult patients, drug-seeking patients, and I lost my zeal for emergency medicine. Had it not been for a mentor and friend, Ken Hyde, who was at the time the EMPA program manager, who offered me an opportunity to basically step back from patient care, back into academia as first as an emergency ultrasound fellow, and then as a program director for our residency program. That has allowed me the opportunity to focus on mentoring PAs, growing their clinical skills, and also mentoring them with clinical research, which is something I've didn't think that I would enjoy, but the more I do it, I've actually grown to enjoy. And I think that there is a paucity of research that focuses on validating PA's clinical skills. We do have a lot of PA research, but it is research that has to do with the profession itself. I don't think that there's a whole lot of clinical research that focuses on the skills of PA. So I think that that's something that actually we need to improve upon is performing studies which demonstrate or validate the skills of PAs and how much alike or similar they are to our physician collaborators that we work with. So during my time as program director, that's what I've had the opportunity to focus on. And it's, again, allowed me to perform less patient care. But that was a good thing, given the situation that I was in and my loss of passion for medicine in general. And in doing so, I've regained that passion. And I'm very thankful for that opportunity.
Now, you did talk about this briefly in your speech as well. But for the people who are listening out, they're starting to lose their way, or they have lost their way, as far as, you know, it's the same thing. I think a lot of people were afraid to talk about burnout, or were afraid that it's like some of the other things. It gets seen it with a negative stigma, you know, suck it up, get over it kind of thing. How can someone who's starting to go down that pathway, who is down there and they're, you know, okay, it's another shift. Why do I have to go? Can I figure out a way to get out of this? Whatever else it takes for them, whatever the thoughts are, what's your way, or what are some of your suggestions on how to maybe change things up enough to get that spark back, or at least keep it in a way to been a benefit both for yourself and your family, but also to your patients?
So the way I look at burnout is essentially it's imbalance with your duties and your work life as compared to your personal life. And so I think that speaking personally, I was able to step back and it allowed me to regain the balance that I needed. I think that when you are a happy person and when you are enjoying what you do, that your patients benefit from that. And I think that burnout can actually hurt our patients if we are losing our compassion that originally led us to a career in medicine, or finding it difficult to be compassionate or have empathy towards our patients. I would encourage people to look for that imbalance in their lives, and if it exists, to look at ways to offset that balance with something, maybe, you know, stepping back into something maybe a little bit more focused on the professional realm of the PA profession, focusing on professional advocacy or leadership or clinical research, which basically can restore that balance that we all need in our careers.
Thank you for that. I guess, what other big things have you been thinking about recently as, I guess, PA or anything else going on? Because it sounds like you've been a busy person as of late.
Yeah, as I said before, when I first started my career, I was just that guy who just wanted to see patients. But there is, our profession needs leaders, it needs advocates. And as I've advanced in my career, I've learned of the expanding opportunities that are available for PAs in those realms, whether they be clinical research or professional advocacy. So, volunteering with organizations like AAPA and working with SPACIS to develop guidelines, in uncharted territory that will actually lead to tangible benefits for PAs in terms of expanding their practice and allowing them to do more and therefore bill more, I think has been a focus of mine over the past couple of years. So I've looked to be a little bit more active in professional organizations in terms of service and helping them deal with the professional issues that we're faced with, particularly in the setting of FPAR, a full practice authority. I think it's a very interesting time for our profession, and it calls for delicate and strong leadership for our profession. So I would encourage people that should you feel that imbalance with your professional life and maybe looking to regain that spark or passion that you originally found, you may be able to find it in those other realms that I just discussed outside of direct patient care.
Perfect. Thank you so much, John, and especially thank you for your service. And so you've been a very busy man, and it's a good thing to be, and obviously you've had a lot of experiences, and I wish we could talk forever about it because it sounds like you have such good information, such good knowledge to share with everyone. Hopefully we can have you back sometime here in the future. Until we get to meet you again next time, can you go ahead and give us the tagline?
Absolutely, Chip. Thanks for the opportunity. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.